Yeah, I think you're right, Alex, that, you know, Wet Movie and Cool Duder and co. really are the consumers. Like, if you are a, if you're a corporate overlord and you are trying to, like, let's say 100 years from now, you know, they're designing consumers in a lab or something, these guys are what you would design. They're, like, the ideal people to buy your products or any products.
Yeah, because I'd say that what's really interesting to me is how everything is just treated as text. Like, there's no subtext to anything. You know, they're always just sort of, well, look, here's the packaging, and oh, it comes in a steelbook edition, and they don't really talk about even the content of the movie or what their feelings are about it, other than saying, oh yeah, it's okay, or oh, this is kind of cool, or this is neat, like, and then they move on to the next one. Like it's an act that's like never completed. Like, they are always searching. Like, they consume the first product and then they move on to the next one. And it's sort of interesting to sort of think about how their cultural consumption is really kind of like the ideal, right? That they're constantly kind of turning over to the next thing. They're never sort of satisfied with sort of sitting with and reflecting with a piece of media for a while. What do you think, Will?
You know what strikes me when I keep watching these Cool Duder Wet Movie videos is how certain pieces of pop culture paraphernalia just keep recurring over and over again. We just watched one. I forget what it was called, but it was Wet Movie and his friend Aaron, and I think is one of them named Carlos.
I mean, there were like two other characters where, I mean, they're like second tier Aaron. There's like a second tier and a third tier Aaron, and it's just impossible to keep track of them all.
They were doing an unboxing. They were opening some of the stuff that various publicity departments of movie studios have sent them. And one of the packages was a new 4K Blu-ray edition of The Goonies. And another one was a new 4K Blu-ray edition of Beetlejuice. And Beetlejuice in particular, these guys are constantly going out to pop-up shows and museums, the word museum in quotes, like, you know, like the Museum of Hollywood or a wax museum or something like that.
The Museum of Blockbuster Video.
Yeah, or they're just like, you know, going to stores or conventions, and there's just so much Beetlejuice shit everywhere. You're constantly seeing that fucking striped suit that Beetlejuice wears. And it's wild because I know that Beetlejuice is a popular movie, but I was never quite aware what an enormous brand it was in this world. Because it's just one movie. It's not even a franchise. It's one movie that came out 30 years ago.
Was it not a cartoon show? I feel like I haven't seen the movie, but when I was a kid.
Yeah, I watched the Beetlejuice cartoon.
These guys, I know they're just like, you know, they're consuming stuff and not reflecting on it. And yet it also feels like there are certain brands that just keep coming back just because they remind these guys of when they were younger. They remember watching Beetlejuice when they were kids, and they're constantly chasing that high. Like, if they're reflective about anything, it's that. Whether it's Beetlejuice or The Goonies or whatever, these things are constantly being re-released just to give you that tantalizing feeling of like, don't you want to feel the same kind of happiness and security that you felt when you were 8?
You know what I loved about this last video we watched is the unboxing, or like the thing that he got in the mail from Warner Brothers or something. Like, there are movies that were already out already. So there was The Goonies, and then I think there were two of the Sherlock Holmes movies, like the ones with Robert Downey Jr. in them. Mm-hmm. But these movies have been out for a while. So he was looking at The Goonies and he's like, oh, I don't think there's any new special features or anything. But it is in 4K, and it's like the perfect illustration of how this type of consumerism, like the rawest form, is all about like just engineering novelty in increasingly, like in a way that yields increasingly diminished returns, but they don't actually care. So it's not as if like this is a new version of a film that he likes, really. Or it's not like when you like a film and, you know, it's a foreign film and you can only get it on like a low rent DVD or something, and then Criterion puts it out and you can see it in a whole new light or something. It's like the resolution is slightly better and that's it. Maybe the packaging is like a little bit different, but that's about it.
I wanted to pick up on what Will's, the point that Will was making about sort of chasing the high of childhood. It almost is like nostalgia for like more stable commodities. You know, we live in a time where, you know, increasingly music, film, things are kind of licensed and subscribe, you get these sort of temporary licenses to things. You know, maybe you just get a digital copy or you just watch it on Netflix. And so it feels a little more ephemeral. And I think with physical media, there's almost this desire to return to a time in which the commodity form was a little more stable. And I think a good illustration of that was, I don't know if either of you ever saw Captain Marvel, but there's this ridiculous kind of sequence, like the first 15 minutes of the film, where Captain Marvel, played by Brie Larson, you know, set in the 1990s, and she like crash lands into a Blockbuster, and then she leaves a Blockbuster video and then goes to a Radio Shack and then makes a communications device out of a Game Boy. And like within about 15 minutes, you have like all these different nostalgic brands, right?
It's very like Ready Player One vibes.
Yeah. And it's like sort of like, hey, remember when you know, the commodity, you used to have to actually physically go to a Blockbuster. You had to actually physically go to a shop to actually get your electronics. They weren't just sort of streamed to you. And there's sort of this nostalgia for a kind of like more kind of stable experience with the commodity form. And I think that's sort of what Wet Movie and Cool Duder and some of these other guys in this universe have.
I have to say, I mean, I think that's a great point, but I am definitely guilty of this myself when it comes to my own habit of needlessly buying vinyl. Because what is it that I like about vinyl? Well, I could give you the standard spiel about like, it has a warmer sound or whatever. But I mean, I do, you know, there are lots of superficial reasons I like it. I mean, I like the packaging. I like the physicality of it. I think the fact that you can, you know, when you buy vinyl, you're buying like an album, and an album is something that you might actually like sit back and, you know, it's like a broad concept that you sit back and receive holistically, to put it in a slightly convoluted way, as opposed to non-physical media today when it comes to music, where, you know, you're just on like a streaming service or you're on shuffle and your music experience, your listening experience can be very disjointed. Like I feel like people hardly listen to albums anymore. In fact, because of things like Spotify, artists are Spotify is changing the way that music is actually produced now, because there's just an incentive to churn out a high volume of it and less incentive to make albums in kind of the classic sense. So why is my habit acceptable, whereas the one that we were just making fun of isn't? Well, because we're cooler than these guys.
I was thinking about the Criterion Collection a lot lately, because there's been a lot of discussion on social media about the role that Criterion plays as like canonizers. And John Semley had a funny tweet this week where he said that Criterion is like Funko Pops for people with BAs, which is like,
oh my God,
really funny. And like, I laugh at that, by the way, because I have like a million Criterion Blu-rays. Criterion has this power to like bestow canonization on a movie, even though like where does it get the power? It's just a business like any other business. But it does seem to have that power, because the products they produce are sort of beautiful in a tangible way. Like the packaging is beautiful. And, you know, movies like music on Spotify in the 21st century, just like online content grist, it's all part of the same soup. But Criterion Blu-rays, even though ultimately they are meaningless, when you have them on your shelf, it looks like it's at least treating the movie with some respect, like it's more than content. It's turning it into an object, something beautiful.
You know what that reminds me of is that James Ellroy, the noir detective author, talked about how whenever he's writing in his room, he actually makes sure that he's surrounded by the books that he's written in hardcover, because it's almost like being like the predator in his den with his kills. And that's actually, Will, when you said that, it kind of reminded me a little bit of that, you know, just like being surrounded by the kind of, I guess, like almost like the aura of an object.
Well, that's why we have books in our apartments, right? Because we've read them, and then you can put them on the shelf, and it's like having a big deer head on the shelf. Like, well, I've read Infinite Jest, and there it is mounted on my wall. Anyway, welcome to Michael and Us. I'm Will Sloan, here as always with...
Yeah, I'm Luke Savage. I guess we should officially start the show. We're flying fast and loose this week, beginning in media res, but welcome back to another Patreon episode. OG fans of the show, listeners from, I guess, season 1.5, will know our guest, returning, I think, for his third appearance, perhaps, of V for Vendetta.
I think it's actually my fourth appearance.
What were you on? You were on Loose Change. You were on V for Vendetta. Was there another one?
Yeah, it was the Alex Jones documentary about Obama, and we had a whole discussion about Alex Jones. I think we also watched the John Ronson episode of his... Secret Rulers of the World documentary series on ITV, the one where he went to Bohemian Grove. with Alex Jones. Right. We sort of had a little a people's forum on Alex Jones. Yeah.
So if you haven't guessed already, our guest is Mr. Alex Ross, our friend and colleague, gentleman, scholar. Sorry, we didn't remember all your appearances, Alex. What you have to understand, and what all the listeners have to understand, is that we've made 2 billion episodes of this show now. This is episode 2 billion and 1, and so it's hard to keep track of them all. But we're glad to have you with us. Before we get into whatever the hell it was we just watched for this week's show, I did want to talk about a few things in no particular order. Did you guys see that Barack Obama's volume 1 of his memoir is coming out in November? He tweeted, "There's no feeling like finishing a book, and I'm proud of this one. In A Promised Land, I try to provide an honest accounting of my presidency, the forces we grapple with as a nation, and how we can heal our divisions and make democracy work for everybody."
Well, I heard that the initial print run is 3 million copies, which is so many copies that they actually have to print some of it in Europe and have it shipped over by boat. I saw somebody tweet, I'm sorry, I can't remember who it was, that Obama destroying the supply chain for the publishing industry is a really funny 2020 subplot.
Well, I think my favorite story with his memoir was he was like interviewed or he had this like petty thing that he said about his wife.
Oh, this was off the record, but it got quoted in the Times.
Yeah, it got quoted where he was like, "Well, it's taking me a lot longer to write my memoir because I'm doing it myself and she has a ghostwriter." And I thought, wow. Way to throw your life partner under the bus. I mean, but this is only volume 1, so there's going to be what, like 2 or 3?
I think there's going to be 2 volumes. I think this one, I read somewhere that it's going to be over 700 pages. I'll have to verify that, but I mean, I know what I think about this. I mean, it promises an honest accounting of his presidency. I don't expect we'll get anything like that, but one thing that really came through in, I probably mentioned on the show before, but Corey Robbins' essay, The Obama Knots for Dissent, that was a review of several staffer memoirs, Obama alum. And, you know, the books themselves, for the most part, come across as pretty drab and predictable. You know, they nonetheless offered a lot of insight into, as it were, what these people kind of thought they were doing and what they think about when they look back on the 8 years that they were in power. So presumably this will, or it could offer something similar. Although I'm anticipating already writing an angry review of it.
I think what's incredible to me in that essay by Corey Robin is just how circumscribed their ambitions were. And I think you've addressed this on the show a few times, whether you're talking about Joe Biden or maybe some other luminary from the Obama White House that's in the media. Because I remember the moment when Obama was elected in 2008, and there was this real sense, I think more than any other presidential election in our lifetime, that, okay, finally, something fundamental is going to change. Something is going to be different. I think, Luke, you've talked about this before, you know, 2 weeks into the Obama presidency, their highest level of approval, you know, they can basically do whatever they want. They're writing, they're assuring David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, that, well, we respect the Reagan and Bush tax cuts. Nothing fundamental will change. And that's just incredible to me. And even also the reports of how he just really dismantled the whole kind of organization that got him elected in the first place. Like, there wasn't really kind of the same type of grassroots that you saw sort of astroturfed by the Republicans as opposition to Obama. Like, there wasn't like a Democratic equivalent of the Tea Party. Like, at the end of the day, it just really seems like the sort of the whole trajectory of liberalism is about disciplining the base, going along with what the powers that be want, and not really sort of questioning those decisions.
Yeah, you know, I think I shared it with you guys in our group DM this week. But I saw that, you know, Michael Moore, I was curious. My girlfriend was asking me, like, is he still doing that show? And I was like, oh, yeah, probably. But let's see who he's had as his recent guest. And, you know, there's like predictably like some interesting guests, you know, like he talked to Breonna Gray, like, you know, people like that, people you'd expect. But then one stuck out like a sore thumb, and that was David Plouffe, whose book I recently eviscerated for Current Affairs. His book, A Citizen's Guide to Defeating Donald Trump, or Citizen's Guide to Beating Donald Trump, something like that. I mean, I haven't listened to it, but Moore plugs the book in the episode, like in the show notes. I mean, it's you know, it's an awful and incredibly boring book, but it does kind of epitomize what elite Democrats and kind of their consultants actually think about when they say grassroots, and what they meant when they said grassroots in 2008. Plouffe was Obama's 2008 campaign manager. They meant people dutifully regurgitating a message that was created from above and maybe adding some kind of local or organic spin on it so that it would seem to be more authentic, because in good marketing, things appear more authentic. That's how you do good marketing. You don't make them more authentic, you just make them seem more authentic.
It's grassroots in the sense that it's normal people tweeting it, regurgitating it.
Right.
Am I wrong? But wasn't David Plouffe, wasn't he behind the Iowa caucus app? Wasn't that one of the things that he, his company, or that he was a consultant on? Wasn't that a project he helped manage? Or and then wasn't his wife, sort of his wife was also involved with one of the campaigns, like the Pete Buttigieg campaign? I'm trying to remember exactly, but I do think he was behind the Iowa caucus app disaster.
It was quite a tangled web. There were a lot of people implicated. I don't remember. I mean, Iowa feels like about a million years ago now, so I don't remember what all the connections were. But if there are any high-ranking Democratic operatives listening, please don't sue us. This is all, we're just flying fast and loose and speculating out loud.
Well, we're talking about stupid online bullshit this week. Luke, you immersed yourself in some stupid online bullshit this week, right? You saw a new documentary about my spirit animal, you know, the fictional character who represents my views. The Pepe Frog.
Yeah, so it's this new film directed by Arthur Jones called Feels Good Man, about Pepe the Frog and Matt Fury, the cartoonist who originally created him. And I have to say, I was a little bit skeptical about, you know, the premise of this film, because if you go back to kind of, you know, 2 or 3 years, you know, in the archives of this show, you can probably hear me expressing some skepticism about, you know, this kind of popular notion that the alt-right, you know, particularly the online, the extremely online alt-right, acted as some sort of vanguard that, you know, helped elect Donald Trump. And I remain a skeptic about that. But as a consequence, I didn't really ever dive into the Pepe meme. Even my work at my last job, where I spent a lot of time covering the extremely online far right, I don't think I really encountered Pepe a lot, or I don't think I really kind of understood the interesting history behind it. But so the film, I think, does a pretty incredible job explaining how this incredibly juvenile comic that's just very well-intentioned and silly became this strange hate symbol. And the film obviously talks a lot about its association with the Trump campaign and things like that. I just wrote a review of it for Jacobin, and in the review I say that, you know, what interested me most was not so much its political incarnation, but as it were, how it arrived at that. The story to me of how you get from a meme of a cartoon frog peeing with his pants down and saying, "Feels good, man," to the same frog with kind of an expression of sinister smugness and like a swastika on its forehead or something, that's actually, I don't know, it's a pretty interesting story to tell. The paradox of a meme is that it has to be broad enough that it can have mass appeal and go viral, but it also has to be, it can't be too broad, because, you know, broadness taken to, you know, far enough just becomes vagueness, and you can't project any meaning onto vagueness, so something loses its symbolic power if it's too vague. And I was interested in the way that the film showed how this meme emerged kind of in an earlier stage of the internet. Like, you know, it originated in 2005, 2006, that kind of time. It was originally posted on MySpace, and this is a period where, you know, social media existed through things like MySpace, but on the whole, the internet was far less professionalized. It was far less commodified. It was a lot more anonymous, because social media hadn't become a mass phenomenon in quite the same way. And so Pepe, when the internet made a transition into this kind of language of bland positivity and like Instagram influencers posting their perfect airbrushed lives and all the rest of it, Pepe kind of got embraced by the, you know, people on these like, you know, anonymous forums, you know, 4chan famously, as almost this symbol of kind of dissent, I guess, you know, among people who really embraced their abjectness, you know, often downwardly mobile young men, embraced it as like a self-conscious identity. And so, I mean, I won't go through the whole film, how it proceeds from here. People can read my review. But I think you can see from what I've laid out, if you're unfamiliar with the history, how those conditions could lead something to be captured by the far right.
The version of Pepe that I always remember kind of associating with 4chan culture was the one where he's kind of holding his, like, he's got like his fingers under his chin, like in this kind of smug expression. And it's funny because like the real, like the Pepe the Frog that Matt Free created, he was just like a stoner. It was almost like this symbol that always indicated, you know, those guys, like kind of like those guys that wear fedoras. And it's like, well, interesting point, sir. Like that was kind of before that itself became kind of widely parodied, you know, the kind of I studied the blade type personality. And that's kind of, and you know, and that's how I first encountered Pepe, is people just posting him, you know, randomly on Twitter or somewhere else being like, epic bacon, sir. You know, just sort of like, so it's kind of weird to think about how he transitioned from that to like basically like wearing an SS uniform. I think also like the use of anime, like anime Nazis, like actually like taking like anime girls and dressing them up in Nazi uniforms is also another kind of weird offshoot of that.
Well, the great thing about art is it belongs to everyone. It doesn't belong to the creator, and we can do with art whatever we want. And if that means turning Pepe the Frog into a Nazi, the consumer is empowered, and that's a beautiful thing.
Well, it's I don't want to dwell on this for too long, but the other thing I found interesting about the film was the way it showed how the particular style of online trolling that reactionaries employed vis-a-vis Pepe, it very much mirrored the Trump campaign, because every attempt to kind of every reaction to it that people had just enhanced its symbolic power. So hilariously, I found an explainer. I had to find it on the Wayback Machine, but it's there. An explainer the Hillary Clinton campaign put out on their official website that was like, it was like a Vox style, like, what is Pepe explainer? One of the most cringeworthy things I've ever read. It's like a series, it's posed as a series of questions, and it includes the line, "That cartoon frog is more sinister than you might realize," which is so funny because part of what was consciously being done with Pepe was, you know, the deliberate owning of people who did react to it, because it was, after all, ultimately a cartoon frog. So if you reacted to it, even if somebody was using it in an incredibly offensive or, you know, racist or sexist way, you were still ultimately reacting to a cartoon frog, which made your reaction kind of ridiculous. And I feel like that transposes pretty nicely onto how the Clinton campaign tried to respond to Trump, you know, because it, obviously, you know, it could have responded with you know, the alternative to Trump could have been a mass socialist politics. But since that was out of the question, all it could really do was just like heap disdain on the people with the Pepe memes, the people with the frog avies. And that just empowered, that just imbued this stupid frog with more and more symbolic power. Like when Hillary Clinton gave that ridiculous speech where she talked about, like, she denounced the alt-right, the online anime Nazis ate it up. Like, they loved it. It was exactly what they wanted, and they welcomed it as a huge victory, because it was. Like, here was the Democratic nominee for president, like, officializing the stupid trolling culture that they'd created and treating it like it was this grave existential threat.
Well, folks, I'd like to take you back to a friendlier, more innocent time on the internet. I'd like to remember it so you don't have to. We are going back to the golden age of the nostalgia critic with his 2010 feature film debut, Kickassia.
There is a nation called Molossia. A micronation, actually. Just a little over an acre of land. Okay, it's not very big, but it has technically been declared a nation. It's run by some nutball named Kevin Baugh, who's declared himself the proud president of this land. Now, Molossia may not seem like much, but Lord knows I've always wanted to own my own nation, and am willing to do just about anything to get one. Even, dare I say it, plan a hostile takeover. I'm the nostalgia critic, and I get a feeling that none of you are gonna have a hard time remembering this.
But it's only an acre of land! What can we do with an acre of land?
What can't we do with an acre of land?
Let's just cut to the chase. I am going to invade you.
I suggest an attack. A full frontal assault by all of us.
Sometimes the best way to deal with a madman.
So, to interrupt, can I just ask what the hell you guys made me watch? What did I just watch?
So basically, just to give like a short summary, back in, you know, 2008, Doug Walker created this character called the Nostalgia Critic to basically review, you know, silly cartoons and movies that he had watched as a child. And I wouldn't really call them reviews. It's almost like summaries with jokes and little skits and things like that.
A lot of clips, too.
A lot of clips, right. He got in trouble for that over copyright and things like that. But yeah, a lot of clips. Basically, you know, this proved so popular on early YouTube that he was able to build like his own little network that was originally called thatguywiththeglasses.com and then later became Channel Awesome. And part of what had happened was that YouTube, after it was bought by Google, you know, was really trying to clamp down on copyright. So he moved his content to a web hosting service called blip.tv and built this website, thatguywiththeglasses.com, where he could sort of get away with playing clips and doing his usual kind of humor.
Because he would use a lot of clips from these movies. He would have, you know, maybe a 30 or 40 minute review of Jungle to Jungle or The Santa Claus or some old piece of shit like that.
Yeah,
and he would, and like that would be 2/3 clip. And he would reveal the whole movie, basically. And he would do criticism that was like the lowest hanging fruit.
Yeah. Always with this kind of screeching voice. And this was very popular. And so what happened was that, you know, he was able to gather a lot of group of like-minded creators. And what's weird about this, from what I've read, is that, and doing some research on Channel Awesome, was that they had to do a similar gimmick to the Nostalgia Critic. So everybody who was on the website had to have like a thing that they did. So Lindsay Ellis, you know, she became the Nostalgia Chick. They had this guy, Louis Lovog, who he called himself Linkara, and he did comic books. And then, you know, you had Film Brain, who's like the kind of really weird British guy in the movie. And they kind of all played these kind of characters, right? Like, so it wasn't just that they would review or do it, but they would do it in the style of this particular character. And what was really obnoxious is that sometimes the characters would enter into the reviews of other people on the website, having debates about who should actually review the thing that was being reviewed.
Because there would be a lot of overlap.
Yeah, a lot of meta, I put that in big air quote stuff. Yeah, so that's basically the context for Kickassian.
When the Nostalgia Critic was in his heyday, I was sort of vaguely aware of him. I saw some of his videos. It's the kind of content that YouTube is made for, which is like it's nostalgic stuff that hits at those nostalgic pleasure centers in your brain. It's like, here's a guy who's going to review Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue or some piece of shit like that. And oh, I remember that when I was a kid. The Super Mario Brothers Super Show, something like that. Oh, yes. I would like to see clips from that and feel nostalgic and see a guy making fun of it. I think he was in his heyday when I was an undergrad, and I regarded him as pretty lame. And I didn't pay much attention to him until about a year or two ago when I became obsessed with him. Because I found out in the interim there had been these anniversary movies. So there would be an anniversary of thatguywiththeglasses.com, which later became Channel Awesome, where they would round up all of these content creators. As you said, the Nostalgia Chick. I don't know who. There's one
Film
there's a guy
Brain.
Called, there's a guy
Todd
called
in
Spoonie.
The Shadows. Yeah, Spoonie. Yeah. Spoonie is like a big one. Yeah.
They would get all these guys and they would fly them out to somewhere and they would film for a week. This first one, Kickassia, which debuted in 2010 in 6 parts online, all it is just inside jokes from all of these people's YouTube videos. And then there were 2 more big anniversary movies, climaxing with one called To Boldly Flee, which is 3.5 hours long. It's longer than The Godfather Part 2. It's longer than The Irishman. And it was filmed in a week. And that's incredible. And when you just skim To Boldly Flee, I would rather watch the Andy Warhol Empire State Building movie. Like, that is more watchable than this.
Yeah, I was going to suggest we call this episode Golly, I Wish We'd Watched Mulholland Drive instead.
well, actually, because these movies look like Inland Empire.
Yeah. Like, they got that kind like, of weird, like, because the thing is, like, yeah, because there's some parts of Inland Empire, right, where they're shooting on a handy cam and
everything's blown out.
And that's like a stylistic choice, right? Whereas like all the movies look like that. It's what's amazing to me about Kickassia is just like how there's like no regard for sight lines. There's no regard for other light sources. There's not even another mic. So they spent less effort on making this movie compared to like what even, you know, we're doing on this podcast to try to make it, you know, somewhat professional. And it's incredible to me that they had so much success, but that they were also at the same time just so lazy. Like, I think success may have come too easily to them, and I think they really took it for granted.
Well, there were a lot of reasons why I wanted to do this particular movie, Kickassia, for this podcast. One of them is...
You wanted me to quit the show.
Yeah, I wanted you to quit the show. I was fascinated by this movie as this time capsule where it's all of these people who are on the internet 10 years ago. And it's just inside jokes from the internet from 10 years ago. And a lot of these people, their videos aren't even online anymore. So it's referencing stuff that actually doesn't even exist. It's like the Magnificent Ambersons. Because Blip TV went out of business. So this content doesn't exist. But also, the only way that a movie this bad is excusable is if it was, okay, a lot of friends got together and they hung out and they made a creative project together. And yeah, it's shitty, but it's just an inside joke and everyone had fun. But it turns out, and this is why I got obsessed with this universe, almost everybody in this movie hates Doug Walker, the nostalgia critic, now because of rampant abuses and just managerial incompetence that went down on the set of these movies.
Can you, like, to boldly flee, they had like 18-hour days shooting for a week, and they constantly failed to provide like food and water. And what's funny too is like actually like the films, because I haven't really sat down and watched the other two. I've kind of skimmed them. But if you watch even this one, it's very mean-spirited. Like the way that he, you know, because, you know, he wrote the scripts himself, the way that he kind of characterizes these people that he ostensibly works with and are, you know, part of his success as an online critic, it's like the most unflattering kind of portrayals, especially I felt Lindsay Ellis kind of really gets some of the most significant, you know, like where she has to do that whole like awful Sarah Palin bit when she's like the vice president of Kickassia.
That was one of the only notes, incidentally, I was able to make. I was trying, usually I make extensive notes when we watch something, but you don't so much watch this as let it wash over you unwillingly. Like that moment you realize you're in a fevered delirium, but you can't quite wake up. I wrote Sarah Palin joke, and that's the only thing I was able to write down. I had no context for what this movie was, except you guys sent me a Salon.com article about the rise and fall of Channel Awesome, or as I soon learned, Channel Not So Awesome. Am I right?
So I'm going to interrupt at this moment and give a plot synopsis of Kickassia. Oh, I'm going to attempt it because
I could not follow this movie at all. The only thing, like, I had no idea what was going on. They have there's some kind of nation state or like a sovereign body, and they decide to mount some sort of assault on a neighboring body, and this forms the central conceit of the movie. Is that correct?
That's right. So the nostalgia critic, which is what he is referred to as. Everybody is referred to by their YouTube name in this movie. So people are like, hey, it's the cinema snob, or hey, it's the game guy. I don't know. I don't know what the other names are.
I'll shut up in a minute and let you summarize the plot. But having no context for this, but then they're just being all these characters known by their like YouTube channel. It was like walking into like a Shelbyville version of the Cool Dude or Wet Movie universe. Everything just like slightly weird and uncanny.
Okay, one more digression. One quick one. Will, do you know what's up with the cinema snob's voice? The way he talks. Like, is that like a is he from California? I can never figure out like his whole shtick where he's like, well, you know, he kind of talk. Is that like a put on, or is that his like natural speaking voice?
I don't know. So I should put all my cards on the table and say that the cinema snob is the other guy who I know who he is, because okay. If you're interested in the kind of movies I'm interested in, you eventually run into the cinema snob on the internet. The sense that I got from him was that was an affected voice where it's like, oh, I'm a snobby voice. Okay. The plot of the movie is that the nostalgia critic discovers that there is this nation state, as you alluded to, and apparently it's real. There's an acre in Nevada or Arizona called Malassia that has been declared a nation in the United States. I don't know why this is, but apparently it's real. And it's run by this one eccentric guy. and the nostalgia critic, because he is the brains of the operation. He pulls in, how many guys are there? 20? And it is mostly guys.
Yeah, it's mostly guys.
And they're all the same guy. Like, it's a slightly...
Yeah, it reminded me of this scene in Being John Malkovich, where John Malkovich, like, goes into that room and it's just a whole bunch of versions of himself saying, Malkovich, Malkovich.
Oh my God, that's so funny. Yeah, they're all, like, slightly overweight, and they have a beard. But he brings them all together, and they do a siege on Malassia. But the nostalgia critic, in art and life, is hardly a benevolent dictator. He runs the show, and everybody gets tired of living under the reign of the nostalgia critic. Oh, yeah, there's the nostalgia chick, who is the vice president, who does the Sarah Palin impression. And, you know, there's a whole midsection of the movie where, again, it feels like Inland Empire. You just get lost.
Well, it's like Inland Empire, soup. But if it wasn't self-aware.
It's so dense with references to stuff that, like, there's a whole section of this movie where a character appears called Santa Christ. And they make a big deal of Santa Christ. I have no idea what Santa Christ is. I assume that this was an inside joke that was fostered over dozens of YouTube videos 10 years ago.
All you need to know is that it's something epic, and these guys are going to be super epic about it.
That's right. Eventually, it ends as you would expect it to end. They no longer run Malassia, or Kickassia, as they call it. The nostalgia critic has been humbled, and they go about their way. But yeah, it's a lot of pop culture references. There are a lot of scenes where people pretend to fight, like in a video game. It is definitely the shoddiest thing we've ever watched for this podcast. Just appallingly, like, very difficult to look at. I mean,
this film made that guy that did the, like, bargain basement doc where he, like, followed Howard Dean around. That guy looks like Fellini compared to this.
Uh-huh. Well, because the thing is, I think, like, Will, like, I think the summary you gave, it really brings everything together, because at the end of the day, like, there really isn't a lot that actually happens. Like, there isn't really a plot. There aren't really characters or ideas or themes. Like, there's no real takeaway. It's basically just a canvas for, you know, Doug Walker to basically write about how awesome he is, and how, you know, look at all these weird people I have to work with. And it's really just a showcase for a series of references. And that's actually led me to, I think, because, you know, like you, Will, a few months ago, I became obsessed with the Channel Awesome movies. And it's actually led me to, a new theory of filmmaking.
Okay.
Well, hit us with it.
Okay. So basically, I think what the Channel Awesome movies, and it's not just like these YouTube movies, like, you know, the Channel Awesome movies, Cinema Snob movie, the Angry Video Game Nerd movie. I think you can also categorize mainstream blockbusters in this, and I call it the epic bacon theory of filmmaking. Basically, okay, these are movies that don't exist to have plots or characters or ideas. What they really only exist to do is to provide the viewers with references to things. So, you know, I think a more mainstream example of this would be, you know, a movie like Captain America Civil War, or a director like J.J. Abrams. If you think about it, so much of these films, they don't really construct, like, real plots. Like, every character has to have their arc or their little moment, not even an arc, like a little tiny moment where they make a reference to something, or the plot has to kind of be strung together in such a way. Or if you think about with J.J. Abrams, you know, how a movie like Star Trek Into Darkness is essentially a remake of The Wrath of Khan, but with, like, only just the references to Wrath of Khan.
Yeah, Khan becomes, like, a pastiche character, but it's, like, it's not at all the Ricardo Montalban Khan who appeared in the Space Seed episode. It's, like, a completely new character.
And it's the same thing with, I think, Kickassia. It's, like, you know, you have these characters, like, you have, you know, Lindsay Ellis pretending to be Sarah Palin, or, you know, you have Doug Walker wearing the uniform of the final boss from Street Fighter. And that's the whole joke. It's like, it's not that it's funny, like, they've actually taken the time to construct plot elements or jokes. It's only supposed to stand for itself. It's the same thing in Star Trek Into Darkness, when there's a scene where you think Kirk dies, and then Spock goes, "Khan," you know, like it's supposed to reference the time that William Shatner does that. So, like, and so that's the thing. It's, like, interesting to me that, you know, you're watching this, like, really low rent, you know, obviously, you know, at least you know, Star Trek Into Darkness and other similar blockbusters.
I'm going to go on a limb and say that Star Trek Into Darkness is better than Kick-Ass.
It is, of course, but I think what's interesting is, like, some of the foundations are the same. Like, it's all about referencing something else. It's about being parasitic on something else and having the reference stand for itself. And what it's supposed to be is that, oh, it's interesting because now I am doing it.
Well, in an earlier fever dream that I think we partly documented on the show, I had a week, I don't remember if it was early in the pandemic or if it was before the pandemic, where I watched every Jumanji movie. People may not be aware of this, but there are three Jumanji movies. There's original Jumanji, which is like, that it's like, it's high modernism, okay? And then there's two postmodern Jumanjis now. And the second one, whatever the Jumanji, the something to do with a video game, blah, 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 whatever. The second one with The Rock in it. That one is like, it doesn't, you know, as you were saying, cleave to any of the kind of like basic premises of the Jumanji universe. It just has all the residual signifiers that this is Jumanji, like the word Jumanji. But the thing just descends into this series of disjointed reference points. Like, there was a part where I was watching it with my friend, and there's just a guy who's an actor they've literally plucked from Game of Thrones that was like big when I guess the movie came out like a few years ago. And then the scene is just them. They're suddenly, for no reason, climbing up the wall that's like the ice wall in Game of Thrones, whatever you call that. They're climbing up the wall like with ice picks, just like in Game of Thrones.
What?
Yeah, and so it essentially, I mean, it makes no sense as a Jumanji movie. The second of the movies kind of tries to, it hints that this is taking place in the same universe. They find like a tree that has like the name of the original Robin Williams character. Like, he's carved it into the tree, and they're like, wow, I guess this is where he lived. But again, yeah, it's just like a reference. I mean, I feel like that kind of sums it up. It's like the first movie, which actually laid out, forms the bricks of this whole universe, is just kind of lazily etched into like a tree in the new one. There's nothing really tangible anymore. It's just a series of reference points.
You know, when I was a kid and I saw Who Framed Roger Rabbit, it was so exciting to me, that scene where Daffy Duck and Donald Duck are playing piano together, because it felt like these are two characters from two different universes and they're together, Daffy and Donald. That's amazing. That's insane. And now I feel like we're just constantly seeing entertainments where characters from different universes are together, whether it's Ready Player One or, you know, the last, I think it was Wreck-It Ralph Part 2. I saw the trailer for that, and it was full of like characters from every Disney property interacting together, and the specialness of it is gone, right? Every character exists in the same pop culture soup now.
Well, this goes back to how we began the episode by talking about, you know, the artificial creation of novelty that's just being delivered in like smaller and smaller amounts. I feel like the cultural imagination has really collapsed. It's collapsed in the same way that the political imagination has collapsed. In the mainstream anyway, politically, nobody can imagine actual progress. So instead, you know, liberal politicians in particular, all they can do is offer this like ersatz version of it, the simulacrum of it. The political imagination has contracted so much that a country like the United States, it is outside of the, you know, the belief system of the ostensible liberal reformers that, you know, the United States could ever have, say, a universal healthcare system, which is a type of institution that would not have to be imagined to being. It already exists throughout the world. So that's how contracted the political imagination is. And the same is true of the cultural imagination. Look at all of the movies that, you know, we constantly are complaining about this on the show. In fact, listeners are probably getting bored of this complaint, but I'm gonna issue it again. I mean, all these movies are coming out and they are literally just, you know, they're not movies anymore. They're warehouses of reference points. Novelty has to be engineered somehow. So it's like, what if we killed off this character? What if we invented a new character who's got two swords? Every movie is now like the Darth Maul lightsaber, where it's like, you like lightsabers? Well, what about lightsaber times two? And since you can only engineer so much novelty through extra lightsabers and explosions and all the rest of it, eventually you got to start doing the name a more ambitious crossover event thing, where you're just mashing together different characters and universes. And, you know, that culminates in something like Ready Player One, where it's just, yeah, this giant soup of reference points. And the dramatic stakes are supposedly like the heroes need to like liberate the reference points so that the fans control the things that are created by the corporations for their consumption.
Yeah, actually, it's funny with Ready Player One, because one of the things that the novel and the movie hinges on is like the final secret is him like unlocking that room in the Atari game Adventure, because that was like one of the first Easter eggs. And it's funny because that is like literally, if you read any popular video game history, if you watch any documentary, that is literally one of the first things you hear about. Oh, well, Warren Robinette, you know, wanted to insert his own kind of, make sure that he was credited for his work. So he inserted his name in a secret room. And it's like so weird to me. Like that's the other thing that I find so bizarre about this culture, is that these things have become so ubiquitous. People know these kind of trivial facts about geek culture. It's not really as much of a subculture anymore as it is mainstream culture. And yet we keep acting as though this is still a subculture, and that, you know, we all need to kind of wink. Like the camera, you know, the characters in the story, they have to constantly wink at you and go, well, this is, you know, this is for the fans. This is for the special people who kept the dream of life alive. And it's like everybody knows this now.
It's like performatively woke liberals on Twitter who act as if the language that they learned like 18 months ago and started using incessantly is like the language of some kind of transgressive, reform-minded subculture or something. But actually, this is just the language that is completely prevalent in certain, like, particularly white middle-class milieus now. There's nothing kind of outsidery about it.
Actually, one of the worst reflexes that I see online all the time, whether it's on Twitter or Facebook, is if you don't know about this, then you haven't been paying attention. And it's so weird to me, because I think the majority of people, especially if they're on social media, have been exposed to this information. It's so bizarre to me. It's something that everybody should know about, but then the person who authored that post also is treating it as some sort of special knowledge that only they're relaying to you. So I find that kind of affectation so weird.
And the other version of that is when somebody does that, like, no one is talking about this kind of thing. And then they're like quote tweeting a news article about a story that has like 10,000 retweets.
Is everyone preparing for battle?
They are, Spoonie. You know, Spoonie, you would really help the team out if you were to, well, you know.
Summon him?
It would just be this once, Spoonie. Just this once, and you can go back to normal.
Normal? There's no normal. I don't even know what normal is anymore. Every day I live with a beast raging inside of me.
All you need to do is set him free, and then once you have him under control...
Control?
To get back to Kickassia, my favorite movie of all time, one of the other reasons why I wanted to talk about it was I find it and the Nostalgia Critic and Channel Awesome so fascinating, is because I find them a perfect sort of synecdoche for a lot of workplaces, and Kickassia is this. It was this public relations strategy. It feels weird to use such a grand word as public relations to talk about a movie like Kickassia, but it was this business that wanted to promote this image of its workplace as being this family atmosphere, this space where everybody is friends with everybody. But in reality, the whole family thing was used to not just mask, but also make a workplace more exploitative than it already was, right? Because none of the people in this movie were paid to be there. They were flown out, but they were all told, you're on the website, you're in the movie. That's exposure. And they were all apparently treated abominably on set. In the three movies, people were injured. People were not fed. I read that in the third one, two of the people were made to do a rape joke. And that, I think, makes watching Kickassia a particularly interesting experience, because the only agenda of it, the only reason for it being, is to suggest that all these people are friends and having fun.
Well, it's funny, though, because in the movie, like, there's just these scenes, because there's so many of them, where they're just trapped. Like, there's really only two rooms in the whole movie. And the producers are trapped in a hotel room, kind of rolling their eyes and oh, what is the critic? God. And every film's like this, where the critic basically coerces these people into doing whatever scheme he's come up with. And it's funny how it kind of, in a weird way, kind of reflects what the reality was, right? Where Doug Walker kind of writes himself as this kind of pretentious egomaniac who's controlling and the lives and has ultimate power over these people, and is forcing them to go along with his whims. And there's even one, I think, scene in Suburban Nights, which is the second one, where one of the characters is like, don't fire me, critic. Like, there's this sort of stuff where it's like this real hostile atmosphere. And I think it's interesting to me that to Doug Walker, this is really funny, but him writing these like really mean-spirited treatments of his characters, I think it kind of gives you maybe some insight into his mind. Like, I think actually Doug Walker, you know, I'm going to say, I think he's a spiteful person. I think he's really resentful. And I think what's interesting is like following the whole disaster with Change the Channel and all the revelations in that document.
And Change the Channel, for context, hashtag Change the Channel. That was all of these creators got this hashtag trending
to report these abuses. Yeah. But I think actually what's funny is like, so that like 75% is what killed the reputation of Channel Awesome. But following that was Doug Walker's review of The Wall, which he also did a parody album of. And it's interesting that like, if anyone was sort of like, didn't care about the Nostalgia Critic anymore, so they didn't really pay attention to what happened with the revelations, or they were kind of indifferent to him, that was sort of the thing that I saw tipped everyone across the internet, no matter what their take on the situation was, into total hostility. Because what's so offensive is that like, he spends all of this time attacking other pieces of art and making fun of them. And yet, I mean, he can't even manage to do like a successful comedy skit. I mean, I don't think his comedy skits are particularly enjoyable. To me, it sort of speaks to somebody who doesn't really quite understand like what the limitations on their particular practice are. And maybe somebody's also resentful of other things. He seems like somebody who doesn't understand like why somebody would express something in a particular way.
Yeah, I got the sense that he was basically like a frustrated comedian or a frustrated sketch comedy guy who was never quite talented enough to make it on his own. So he uses the low-hanging fruit and the easy targets of these like old movies and TV shows.
Well, I still have no idea what this movie was about, but I'm glad that we could do this podcast to finally call out some of the labor issues associated with the production of 2010's Kick-Assia. So did they in fact capture and occupy the acre large nation they invaded?
Well, correct? Yes, this is a documentary film about the Nostalgia Critic and the Cinema Snob and the Nostalgia Chick, as their Christian names are, overpowering this place. One more thing I'll say about this awful movie and this terrible phenomena that it represents is that if you go on YouTube and you search the Nostalgia Critic, you will see video after video after video of people doing takedowns of him, people talking about the hashtag Change the Channel controversy. And this is another reason why I'm so obsessed with this topic, because there was a whole generation of, let's call them content creators, quote unquote, which is such an ugly phrase, but we'll use it. Content creators who grew up with these guys, grew up loving Doug Walker and loving this universe that was represented in these movies, wanting to be part of this universe, because these are guys that a certain kind of person could aspire to be. Well, hey, I love nostalgic stuff and I'm kind of snarky, so I could have a successful YouTube channel. And there are so many videos online of people who seem kind of betrayed on a primal level by Doug Walker.
It's like, is nobody pure?
Yeah, and it's kind of fascinating to me because, like, you know, to me, he's always been, you know, kind of lame, kind of stupid, bit of a joke. But he gets 500,000 views, a million views sometimes on some of these videos. He's wildly popular in certain corners of the internet. And it's just a whole other reality, you know? It's like, he, I think, is much more influential over the last 5 or 10 years over people practicing, let's call it broadly, the art of film criticism than Pauline Kael is.
I mean, we've ourselves witnessed a kind of a smaller scale version of this through our extensive consumption of Wet Movies YouTube channel, because I mean, he really is like the alpha dog of that universe. And it is a universe. Like, people watch those guys, they watch all their channels, you know, there's kind of an extended universe. Wet Movie is by far, you know, the most successful one. I think he's surpassed Cool Duder now, but he has tens of thousands of subscribers. And, you know, in the same way that he looks up to a guy like Kevin Smith, you know, he looks up to people who made something in a sort of ad hoc way and got big. The people who are kind of lower than him in the pecking order look up to him and they're like, well, I'm going to have a YouTube channel and like, maybe I can, you know, maybe I can get a piece of that. Well, I still don't know what the movie was about, but Will made us watch it. He told me it was going to be 60 minutes. It was, in fact, 90 minutes, which is 30 more minutes than the 60 minutes he said it was, which is 33.3% longer than he'd originally indicated. So I just want to register that in protest to explain in advance why I'm quitting the show.
This is stupid! This is stupid! Stupid, 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 stupid!
Okay.
So I don't know if you guys saw this week that Jim Carrey was announced to be playing Joe Biden on Saturday Night Live.
Oh yeah, I mean, only 90s kids will know who that is. It's a real deep cut.
But the thing is, how is he going to play Joe Biden? Because I feel like Jim Carrey has like a particular sensibility, a particular kind of, like, I would call it like a crazy man act. And the thing is, I feel like you can't really do that for Joe Biden, even though it would actually kind of work in a way.
I can already picture it. It's like, it'll be, they get Jim Carrey because, you know, as part of the eternal and ever frustrated quest to make Joe Biden epic. So like, okay, sketch idea. We're in the writer's room. The sketch topical, it's the California wildfires. And Jim Carrey as Joe Biden looks at them and he says, "Smoking."
Right.
He does Fire Marshal Bill over again.
Yeah.
I do think that this is evidence of some sort of imperial decline, though, that like every major public figure, everybody from the Trump administration or every major Democratic politician on that show gets played by a major movie star now. It used to be that cast members would play these characters, but now it's, you know, Matt Damon comes out as Brett Kavanaugh, or Michael Keaton plays Julian Assange, or I don't know, Melissa McCarthy plays Sean Spicer. And I feel that this is wrong. Movies are no longer at the center of culture. There is no monoculture anymore. The closest thing there is to anything like a monoculture is Saturday Night Live. It used to be that SNL cast members would want to become big movie stars, but now big movie stars want to go on SNL, and I feel like that's unsustainable. I feel like this is a system that will eventually collapse in on itself, and it's not right.
And what replaces it?
I don't know. It's like a shooting star or something.
Well, Will, isn't this your point about, like, you weren't alive for the birth of movies, but you're alive for their death? Isn't that like a big part of your thesis right now?
I said that when I went to see Doolittle starring Robert Downey Jr. And little did I know that I was actually right when I said that, because the pandemic struck a month or two later. And movies are dead now.
Always sort of tackle what the majority of people are thinking at the moment. Or even if they're not, sort of their ability to show a mirror to people and say, this is what you're acting like. This is, you know, this is you. You know, is this what you want to be? They are so good at that. And they really do take no prisoner. They just go all out there. Many times it really has gotten them in trouble. But they just keep doing their thing, and they're not gonna change. You know, I mean, they are always gonna fight for, you know, freedom of speech and to say what we want and so forth. And what they do have to say is hilarious. Every time South Park comes on, I always sort of say to myself, I don't want to watch that lowbrow whatever. I watch the first 5 minutes, I'm hooked. I have to watch the rest of it every time. That's always my reaction. And I guess maybe there is something to just the fact that it is, you know, sort of crude smut toilet humor and stuff like that. I mean, that is just, really, I'm laughing at there. I'm supposed to laugh at this sometimes. But what they tie it together with is always so humorous, and it's just so extreme. But it doesn't matter because it's so smart and it's so clever, and it's working off of something that they feel very passionate about and they want to really do a comment about. And they really make us understand where they're coming from and why they think this. And why you probably should too. And they sort of have become this voice of, I don't want to say they became a voice of a generation, but anytime something happens, something big or something goofy or whatever, people want to see how South Park is going to react to it. They want to see what their opinion is. They want to see how they're going to tackle it. And let me tell you, that can apply a lot of pressure for these people, for the Trey and Matt. You know, and they can have that affect their writing or be cautious about who they're going to offend. And they really just tell it how it is. I mean, even stuff that would probably be very controversial to their fans, you know, that you would think their fans wouldn't enjoy this, or they wouldn't like, they think it's a cop out, or they wouldn't agree with their opinion. They just tell it because that's how they see it. At least it seems like it is. I'm not behind the scenes, I don't know. But it seems very much like that. So it really has lasted so